Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Broadcasting live from New York City, not our studio. I'll be there tomorrow. Just made it in. Got to phones, so now we have our program. Have a big premiere tonight. Sorry, it's sold out. In fact, standing room only. Look forward to seeing a lot of people there. Today we're going to talk about health and healing, as we always do. I'm going to give you very special food that I believe you should have every day in your diet. Also, from our public health segment, I'm going to talk about an issue that doesn't get discussed. Two issues. One is nearly half, 50% of all U.S. women don't know heart disease is their number one killer. So here's the idea. How can we save women's lives? So that's what I'll be talking about also today. And for those of you taking antibiotics, there are times when antibiotics are necessary. There is no question. It's not controversial. Antibiotics are one of the great healing modalities of all time. But what happens when we overuse it? What happens when we use it too long? What happens when it's in our food and we're not even aware of that? I'll talk about that. Then today we're going to hear one more segment in our ongoing effort to educate people about Gaddafi in Libya. It is my contention, based upon doing over 1,000 hours of research on this and speaking with people who were on the ground before, doing business in, living in, scholars in Libya, that there was absolutely not only no threat to the United States or anyone else in the world, but actually it was the stabilizer for all Africa. So needless to say, then why do we destroy the country? Looks like Hiroshima. Why? And why is the mainstream media not said a word about Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and virtually the entire neocon, Beltway pundits, Fox News, and the other blithering idiots on that station? These people have no brains. I watch and I'm embarrassed by the lack of any sense of intellectual depth. Now, I don't even consider MSNBC worth criticizing. It's so dumb. So you will know the truth today in ways that the mainstream media and alternative media will not share you on Libya. And I'm going to keep hammering this. I can promise you I will do more and more and more to show you how you've been lied to, manipulated by the people who are slick willies, the people who give you their charm and tell you that, oh, well, look at us, we're on the right side. No, they're not. They're not on the right side. So we're going to get with all this. And today, what does it mean to be normal? Well, we're going to take a look through the eyes of a man who I filmed for an upcoming documentary, Brilliant Mind. You may not be aware of him, but you will after this. It's a short piece. And I'm also going to give you an opportunity to take a look at what goes on inside the banking community. I've recently said on this program, and historically as well, that we don't need Wall Street. And people think, well, that's crazy. Our entire financial system is Wall Street. America would collapse, the world would collapse if any of these big banks, if Citigroup, if Bank America, if Morgan, if any of these went broke, the world would collapse. Not true. Just the opposite. It is because of them that we're at risk. It's because of the Federal Reserve, a completely criminal organization, and the Bank of England, which is not the Bank of England. It's not for the people. It's a private bank. And the European Central Bank and the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. These are criminal organizations. But unless we get very detailed and give you specifics, people won't recognize this. So today, professor of political economics at Santa Clara University in California, Dr. Jack Rasmus will be my guest. And we are going to talk about this in depth, about how can we wean ourselves away from this corrupt banking system that controls so much of our life and economy and provides all of the debt loans to major corporations to create monopolies and manipulates us. We're going to deal with that. So we have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. First up, there is a problem with women's perception of what caused them to die. The number one reason women die in the United States is because of heart attack or strokes. And this is from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Quote, Women's Heart Alliance surveys show more than a third of women report having a moment when they thought something was wrong with their heart. Almost half, 50%, put off seeing a doctor until they can lose weight. Nearly half of U.S. women don't know heart disease is their number one killer. Quote, women and their physicians are largely uneducated when it comes to females and heart disease, putting women's health and lives at greater risk. This study is published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, and it shows that they're not paying attention and physicians are not paying attention. Quote, we clearly have a lot of work to do to make women aware that heart disease is a bigger threat to their health than all types of cancer combined. That's from Dr. Noel Meritz, MD, director of the Barbra Streisand Women's Heart Center at Cedars-Sinai Heart Institute. Okay, so let's break this into its component parts and see what we can do. First, women, you do not always have some of the signs of heart disease or stroke before you have it. I was speaking with a person yesterday who told me of a loss. Now, this is a person who's almost completely reversed hepatitis C, which had almost killed this person, and now they are almost completely eliminated from their body. They've been on a long protocol, but they're healthy now. And their person's husband just died this year of a heart attack. And the heart attack comes from heart disease, not just a blockage. And when I asked some questions about what was his diet, well, it wasn't that important to him. He felt as long as he played tennis every day and kept himself into some good shape that, you know, that would prevent heart disease. Not true. Not true. That's a myth. You can play 16,000 hours of tennis, not help you at heart disease at all, prevention. Secondly, what was his diet? It was pretty good. I mean, he didn't have a bad diet. He had some healthy things. Okay, so now we get into that game playing that people do, that this idea that I can do something that's not healthy because I like it, as long as I throw in something to appease my guilt. I'll throw in an occasional vitamin C, or I'll have a glass of apple juice, or I'll do something I can say, well, I had my salad. What kind of salad? Was it from organic produce? Was it iceberg lettuce? Did you have a heavy sugared salad dressing? These are very important questions. In any case, then when I said, tell me exactly, in detail, what he ate and drank for an entire day, every day. Well, I don't know. Wouldn't you think that, did you know what kind of gas? Oh, he knew everything about the gas. And he once told me, if you get the wrong gas, it's going to kill your engine. But no one paid attention to his diet, what went into his body? No. Okay. And you're a nurse for 38 years? Yeah. And you listen to my radio show every day? Yep. Well, then what are you listening to? And then you get this cognitive disconnect between the idea that someone listens, but they don't apply, or they don't apply except tokenism. So by the time she finished explaining the diet, his lack of exercise, and his being overweight, and his stress levels, and being, you know, in some toxic work environment, everything was negative. Everything. So I said, where's the happy outcome supposed to come with your health if everything a person's doing is not promoting health? So for all the women, and that was just yesterday, so it just kind of connected with what I'm talking about now. Now think of women. You're stressed. That's a killer. Up goes cortisol. Every time you get anxious, every time you get angry, every time you get rageful, every time you get depressed, every time you're disappointed, every time you're upset, cortisol, your stress hormone, which you need for about a minute to a minute and a half to flee or fight, but that's not what's happening. You're not looking at fleeing. It's built in. It's genetic. It's hardwired. Or fighting. And it's not about fighting. It's about dealing with circumstances outside of your control. Well, that raises your blood sugar, raises your insulin level, raises your cortisol level. All these different hormones go up. When that goes up, your heart is under attack. Your arteries are under attack. Because cortisol, when it stays up, is a killer. Right up there with alcohol, right up there with methamphetamine, elevated cortisol kills. Understand that. So every time you get angry, you've just taken a couple days or weeks off your lifespan. Now you got to look at your diet. Do you give it living foods, foods that are rich in enzymes and healing energy and phytonutrients and chlorophyll and antioxidants and high-quality fibers? If you do, that's healing. If you're not, that's diseasing. And it doesn't happen all at once. The diet starts to cause erosion of your epithelium, the arteries, linings. And that means that you could have hundreds to thousands of little specks and scabs, and that can break off and that forms a clot. And what about oxygenation? When you're taking in alcohol, it destroys oxygen. Smoking destroys oxygenation. All right? You want oxygenation. You want the bioactive, like trimethylglycine, TMG, a couple hundred milligrams. Why do you think, in going clear back to the 1970s with our Natural Living Running and Walking Club, I would have people take about 10 of those, little tiny taps you put under your tongue, and it oxygenates. It's a methyl donor. It's donating methyls of oxygen, which gives you more oxygenation into your tissue. Hence, you're going to have less weakness, less fatigue. Senior citizens would really benefit from it. People who are tired would benefit from it. But your heart benefits from it. What about being overweight? Are you exercising twice a day? And including in that exercise, some intense exercise. And then are you taking the nutrients? Please write this down, because if you wrote this down and you took it, I'm going to guesstimate we could stop 500,000 deaths a year in the United States. 5 to 10,000 milligrams a day of vitamin C, 5,000 milligrams of quercetin. You could cut heart disease in half. Throw in vitamin E, mixed tocopherols with tocotrienols, 800 units of mixed tocopherols and 200 tocotrienols, and you're oxygenating the blood. You're thinning the blood naturally. The vitamin C thins it. Now throw in some chlorophyll. Throw in 2 or 3 glasses of vegetable juice a day, green vegetable juice, which is great. Celery, cucumber, green apple, throw in some ginger and lemon, and wow, you're just given nothing an opportunity to cause disease. How simple, how inexpensive. But then watch the anger, the rage. You're a quack for doing that. Really? Really? You cured anyone of AIDS? I have. Whole bunch. They were on national television. You didn't watch them? You didn't care? You were threatened by it? You had to attack because of it? You killed 200,000 to 300,000 people, and yet you are considered the expert? We heal people, and we're the enemy? That's how perverse our system has become. Doctors who decide one day to deprogram themselves. I just interviewed a guy. He's in a film. And he's approaching 80, and he said, "Oh, I had a good morning this morning, Gary. What was it?" "Well, I did 85 pull-ups, okay, 600 sit-ups, that's not bad, and 200 push-ups." Near 80, a vegan, a doctor that can, if needed, use a drug, but rarely if ever does. Yeah. Now, where do you think he fits as a board-certified physician, graduated from Columbia, medical school? Where do you think he fits in the paradigm? How welcome do you think he's going to be? Who's going to want him to lecture? No. They'll do everything they can when they know about him. He practices quietly. And why? Why aren't you out there? Why don't we see you on, you know, television talking about the patients you've... Gary, it's very, very simple. Any doctor, he says, in America who can improve or cure a disease without medicine is going to be considered a threat to every other one of those 900,000 plus doctors. The U.S. Public Health Service, the FDA, the Center for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Mental Health. Oh, yeah, and he's a board-certified psychiatrist. So imagine how that would go down if he's saying, we don't have an epidemic of ADD and ADHD. There is no such thing as bipolar. And exactly where would his information, where he's helping patients, where would that fit? Again, dominant, everything else subordinate, it collapses. So in the honeycombs of life, the people with the truth live. From the organic farmer to the holistic cardiologist. That's how it works. So now you have something that can help save lives. And by the way, something that doesn't save lives is continuing those courses of antibiotics that you were told, finish your antibiotics, finish your chemotherapy, finish your radiation. Well, one of my buddies, Jerry Krupman, phenomenal photographer, he shows up one day on my ranch down in, where I was living down in Tioga, Texas, and he was just a little shell of a person when he came on. I said, what happened, Jerry? He said, oh, I got my, you know, brain cancer. They successfully operated and got it out, but then they just kept doing more and more and more and more radiation. And he said, now I can't eat. I can't keep food down. I can't keep liquid down. I've lost all this weight, and I can't sleep. I'm sick. And he would ultimately die from radiation toxicity. And so they succeeded in getting the cancer and killing the patient. Boy, isn't that common. And they do the same thing with antibiotics and chemotherapy. This is the latest. This is from Kay Catley, from Health Correspondent, The Times. Quote, and by the way, this is the Times of London, the most respected newspaper in the world, not the rag of the New York Times. Quote, finishing a course of antibiotics could harm you. It is a mantra followed by patients across the country. Always complete the full course of antibiotics, even if the ailment is no longer there and long forgotten. Now, specialists have warned that such advice is not backed by evidence and could be increasing drug resistance. Doctors could instead tell patients to stop taking medication when they feel better, and that's in the current British Medical Journal today. They had all this concern. Well, what about those of us who've been this concerned, especially when you have 50,000 people a year die because of antibiotic-resistant infections? The research was done at Oxford University. So finally, after you had been warned and you fortunately, hopefully, took that advice, if there is a time when you need an antibiotic, and there may be, take it until you're feeling better, then stop and load that body up with massive amounts of probiotics, 10 times a day. But they forgot to tell you about the probiotics, and they forgot to tell you to stop taking it when you feel better. And as a result, you might have been taking 10, 100 times more antibiotics than what you needed, and instead of the good bacteria, you just were loading up with the bad because those antibiotics are destroying bacteria, and then now resistant bacteria grow in their place. And yet they're seeing hundreds of thousands, millions of people over the years die from antibiotic-resistant infections that, had they treated them differently, wouldn't have died. Finally, pomegranate juice. Now, this is a good one. This is from Sfax University in Tunisia, and the Otto University in Germany and published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients. It says, quote, supplementation with pomegranate juice may reduce oxidative stress and improve recovery time after intensive resistance training. Weightlifters who consume pomegranate showed a reduction in oxidative stress both immediately after training session up to 48 hours later. Quote, supplementation with pomegranate juice has the potential to attenuate oxidative stress by enhancing antioxidant responses associated acutely and up to 48 hours following an intensive weightlifting session. Okay, so here's what we're going to do with this. I'm going to show you how easy it is to extrapolate. First of all, your average dim-witted scientist and your completely clueless doctor say, well, all right, okay, that's some, okay, all right, we get it. What about if I'm a bicyclist? No, we haven't seen that study yet. What about if I'm a jogger? Haven't seen that one. What if I swim? Haven't seen that. What if I power walk? Haven't seen that. So in other words, until you get a study in every single area, you don't see the cumulative evidence that if it worked for one sport, it will work for all sports because all athletes at the biological are participating in the same oxidative stress reaction. And then their brains explode because they just can't understand what the hell you said. That's how conditioned they are. So what I'm saying is any athleticism, any at all, you take your 4 ounces to 6 ounces of pomegranate juice afterwards, and it will make an enormous improvement. Now, here's the second. It says four times in here about oxidative stress. One of the reasons that we age prematurely, one of the reasons we die before we should is because of the effects of oxidative stress. Now, oxidative stress is just a normal part of living. When you breathe in, oxygen is coming in. When you exhale, carbon dioxide is going out. That's oxidative stress. That's a simple reaction. So you can't avoid oxidative stress, but when you get stressed, you increase oxidative stress. When you're in a polluted environment, air particulates in the air, that increases that. Those living in China and in many other places, Weirton, West Virginia. I went out one day when I was living in Weirton, and lo and behold, all the snow that had just fallen that morning was already red and yellow from the particulate matter from the smokestacks from Weirton Steel and Wheeling Steel. So that air pollution, water pollution, you drink water that's polluted, you don't have a filter, oxidative stress. You eat meat, oxidative stress. Sugar, oxidative stress. Alcohol, massive amounts of oxidative stress. Smoke marijuana, 116 times the carcinogenicity of cigarettes. Sorry to discourage some of the people who love their marijuana, and now they get so stressed they'll just smoke more of it. God, what a group. So anyhow, oxidative stress big time with marijuana smoking. But I feel so good. I'm glad you feel so good. But you're killing yourself too, dude. You know that? Really? Now I'm stressed. I'm going to smoke 4 more right now because you just stressed me out, Gary. So just understand something. We got a lot of dumb people. Understand that if it says pomegranate juice reduce the oxidative stress, then that means everyone in the world would benefit from pomegranate juice every day because we're all involved in oxidative stress every second of every day of our lives. So take your pomegranate juice every day and you can help your body measurably. So that's the latest on health and healing. We are halfway through our program. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to take on a couple issues, and then we're going to go to our guests. Please stay with us.
I get
Nice to have you listening in. We got people from all over the world listening right now, and I try to make the themes universal. Well, this is universal. Fascism, imperialism, hidden agendas, the deep state, the corporate interests that profit off you being afraid, terrified, and controlling your reaction so that they can arm up. And they did this in Libya. We're going to go back to that subject for a few moments now. I'm just going to keep sharing with you how you were lied to, who lied, what was the consequence, and the fact that no one's gone to Libya. I think it would be, I even mentioned yesterday, I would pay for a plane load of the people who caused the war to go over there and walk the streets and walk down and say, friend, how's it going now that Gaddafi's gone, that terrible beast that was here, that was killing his own citizens? They're going to look at you, and you better have running shoes on to get back on that plane real fast, because everything you were told was a lie. Everything. Now, it might have been a lie by ignorance, omission, or commission, but no one went there to find the truth. Here's a little dollop of that truth.
Speculation has been raised on the reasons for NATO's intervention in Libya. And as RT's Laura Emmett reports, the organization may have been trying to prevent Gaddafi from burying the American buck.
According to some, it's about protecting civilians.
We must not tolerate this regime using military force against its own people.
Others say it's about oil.
The only reason they're interested with Libya is about the oil. You'd think we'd be in Iraq if the major export there was broccoli.
But some are convinced intervention in Libya is all about currency, specifically Gaddafi's plan to introduce the gold dinar, a single African currency made from gold, a true sharing of the wealth.
It's one of these things that you have to plan almost in secret, because as soon as you say you're going to change over from the dollar to the something else, you're going to be targeted. There were two conferences on this. One in 96 and another one in the year 2000, called the World Mataba Conference, organized by Gaddafi. And everybody was interested. I think most countries in Africa were keen.
Gaddafi didn't give up. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold. The UK has double that, but 10 times the population.
I do have one question. During the crisis, or any time that you're aware of, has the Federal Reserve or Treasury participated in any gold swaps arrangements?
The Federal Reserve does not own any gold at all. We have not owned gold since 1934.
The Federal Reserve does not own any gold at all. We have not owned gold since 1934. The Federal Reserve does not own any gold at all.
If Gaddafi had an intent to try to reprice his oil or whatever else the country was selling in the global markets and accept something else as a currency, or maybe launch a gold dinar currency, any move such as that would certainly not be welcomed by the power elite today, who are responsible for controlling the world's central banks. So yes, that would certainly be something that would cause his immediate dismissal and the need for other reasons to be brought forth for removing him from power.
It's happened before. In 2000, Saddam Hussein announced Iraqi oil would be traded in euros, not dollars. Sanctions and an invasion followed. Some say because the Americans were desperate to prevent OPEC from transferring oil trading in all its member countries to the euro.
The UK's gold is kept here in a secure vault somewhere in the depths of the Bank of England. As in most developed countries, there's not enough to go around. But that's not the case in places like Libya and many of the Gulf states. A gold dinar would have given oil-rich African and Middle Eastern countries the power to turn around to their energy-hungry customers and say, sorry, the price has gone up and we want gold. Some say the US and its NATO allies literally couldn't afford to let that happen. Laura Emmett, RT, London.
President Obama unequivocally putting Muammar Gaddafi on hold in a phone call to German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The president said Gaddafi was using mass violence as his only means of staying in power, that Gaddafi had lost legitimacy, and for the first time, that Gaddafi should leave now. And late last night, the White House rolled out new sanctions against Libya, blocking bank accounts and freezing the assets of Gaddafi, his regime, and senior and his children. The president had held back on calling for Gaddafi to step down until U.S. citizens were safely out of the country. Today, the president intensified the pressure. Russ.
Joel Brown at the White House.
Well, right now, diplomats the world over are scratching their heads on how to manage the situation in Libya. And on top of sanctions, Colonel Gaddafi now faces the possibility of a no-fly zone over his country. British Prime Minister David Cameron said he would work with his allies on preparations for such a plan and would not rule out the use of military assets. At the same time, the United States is also repositioning its naval and air forces around Libya. The BBC's diplomatic correspondent James Robbins is following that part of the story.
These extraordinary pictures, apparently from the town of Misrata, suggest the scale of violence in parts of Libya as ground is fought over. And these images are thought to come from the same town, as Colonel Gaddafi's regime is squeezed both by the scale of rebellion and increasing global pressure on him to give up now. First, the diplomatic pressure.
We're going to, just to give you a little bit of perspective here and context, Gaddafi had invaded no one. Gaddafi was working with the United States and England. In fact, the UN had just announced the year before that he was one of the most stabilizing forces against terrorism. The people in his prisons were over 600 terrorists from Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra. Gaddafi's citizens were the most prosperous in Africa, the healthiest in Africa, the longest lived in Africa, the best educated in Africa, of the whole continent. The greatest human-made project for water. He did all that. But he also had half the gold of England, but one-tenth the population. Therefore, he had something that could have changed, transformed the way all those countries in Africa dealt with their products being exported. The gold denier. And in emails that were leaked by WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, they show this. They show that Hillary Clinton knew that terrorists were being armed by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates. They knew that Libya had not started a rebellion, were not killing its own citizens, but it was a vital asset. They needed it. Well, did anyone ask what happened to the 124 tons of gold, one of the largest collections of gold in the world? The United States got it. And then which oil companies went in later to get this new government they tried to put into a place? And there is no government in Libya. It's all fighting factions now. So I'm just going to keep hammering away at the idea you've been lied to about everything, and this is just one example, and no one's willing to say, maybe we made a mistake here. Maybe we should start thinking before we do this. But these people thought well about what they were doing. This was not an accident. Joining us now is Professor Jack Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S. He is professor of political economics at St. Mary's College, as well as Santa Clara University in California. And he has a deep background in economics, as he was an analyst for several global corporations and an organizer, negotiator, and business representative for several labor unions. And at one time, he also was vice president of the National Writers Union. In addition to his economic profession, Jack is also a playwright, and he looks at social and labor struggles in the United States. He is the author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Next Depression. And he does a program on the Progressive Radio Network every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. His website is jackrasmus.com. Nice to have you with us today, Jack.
My pleasure.
Jack, I'm going to ask you three questions that all are connected. If you would address them in your own way, I'd appreciate it. First and foremost, at no point do we look at the actual debt versus the actual economic assets and stability of the United States economy, let alone the world economy. That's number one. But if we did look at it, and we've done a very careful analysis, only using official figures, and we find that the United States, at the most conservative, is holding close to $172 to $200 trillion in debt, and only each year approximately $19 trillion in gross domestic product. But that's not really an actual figure, because at least 5% of that is consumer debt used on credit cards. So you can't, unless you're engaged in economic alchemy, make a debt into an asset the way they've tried to perceive this as being. So it's not disposable income or savings we're talking about. It's debt. Person can't afford food. They pay for food on their credit card, knowing they'll pay in a month. If they can't afford their electric, they pay for that. Well, that's 5% of our gross domestic product. So here we are, over 1,200% minimally debt to asset, and yet no one talks about the viability of changing the way we do our economic system in America, as if our system is perfect the way it is, it's the model of the world, and everybody keeps praising it. Trickle-down economics, laissez-faire. That's one. Two, the central bank has inordinate power to control currency, to control how much money is put into the circulation, to control the interest rates. And yet, it is not controlled by the government. It is not accountable. It is not audible. It is controlled by 12 central banks, which themselves, we do not know who the controlling interests are because they're not audible. They don't have to show who controls large blocks of stock in these banks. And also, when we look at the troubles in our economy, the only people running our economy, every single Treasury secretary has been from Wall Street, and many have been from Goldman Sachs. They go there, they come back. Policies are made based upon what benefits Wall Street, not the consumer. So my hypothesis is the following. If we were to allow the too big to fail banks to go through structured bankruptcy, eliminate immediately all credit defaults and all derivatives, which are not helping anyone in the world except them, then we would be in a better situation than allowing them to control the destiny of our economy. Your thoughts, please.
Well, first of all, when you talk about debt, you have to distinguish between general government debt, private debt, which is corporate debt on the one hand and household consumer debt on the other, and then this quasi entity here, which most people think is government, but really isn't, and that's the central bank and their debt levels. And, of course, what's the relationship between the debt, the private sector, the general government, which is federal, state, and local, and the central bank? Well, the central bank debt officially is $4.5 trillion. That's the balance sheet, as they say right now. But the cumulative balance sheet that they've run up since 2009 is really over $7 trillion. You know, as some of the debt matured, the Fed simply rolled it over and bought more securities from the private sector. You see, the central banks have bailed out the private sector, the Federal Reserve. It's not the government that bailed out the banks. It's the Federal Reserve, the central bank that bailed out the banks. And that's what the role of central banks always has been for the last century and a half. And central banking is really a phenomenon of the last century and a half. Central banks originated out of the private banking system. They were private banks, and they still remain quasi-private banks. And that's who controls the Federal Reserve. It's really the banks. The Federal Reserve was created in 1913 by the banks themselves for the purpose of bailing them, the private banks, out periodically, which always happens under capitalism, by simply creating fiat money and buying up the debt of the private banks. So if you look across the world, the major banks, major private quasi-central banks, the European Central Bank, Bank of England, Bank of Japan, People's Bank of China, U.S. Fed, well over $20 trillion of debt bailing out banks has occurred since 2009 alone. $20 trillion is what the bailout, the direct bailout of the banking system cost. And what did we get for that in terms of real growth? Well, Japan has been in four or five recessions since 2009, at least a double dip, maybe triple dip recession in Europe. And U.S. Growth has been like 60% of normal. So $20 trillion to bail out the banks, and we get a small, historically slow economic growth. Now, that's significant and different. There's been the global capitalist economy has crossed a kind of Rubicon in 2008-09, and it hasn't really been able to recover. There's still $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans across the advanced economies. In other words, not loans by banks to private businesses that haven't been paid. It's a very unstable situation still, despite $20 trillion. Now, where did that $20 trillion go is the question. If it didn't go into real growth, where did it go? Well, most of it went out of the U.S. and out of Europe into emerging markets because the profits were higher there. A lot of it went into investing in financial asset markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, foreign exchange, and so forth, neither of which generates real economic growth in those advanced economies. That's why the economies have been so slow growth or no growth or multiple recessions. A third place where that money has gone is borrowed by corporations by issuing corporate bonds because interest rates are so low as a result of the $20 trillion. And the money is used by corporations to pay off their big investors, their big shareholders. Just since 2009 in the U.S. alone, corporate bond issuance has been over $6 trillion. And they've distributed in stock buybacks and dividends about $6 trillion. Companies like Apple, which have $250 billion in cash, still issue corporate bonds. They hoard their cash, they issue the corporate bonds, and they use the bond money to pay off their shareholders. That's why you've got so much inequality. The 1% is so filthy rich. Because the tax system is set up where they can just pass all that money through and to the shareholders. But it all begins with the central banks because they're the ones that have pumped into $20 trillion into the economy that's gone offshore, emerging markets, multinational companies, has gone into financial assets, has been distributed, or it's been distributed to shareholders, or it's just hoarded on private corporations' balance sheets. U.S. multinationals are holding offshore in their subsidiaries in order to avoid paying U.S. taxes at least $2.5 trillion. Banks are sitting on over $1 trillion of excess reserves. So those are the four places where this $20 trillion is gone, but the point is it hasn't gone into generating the real economy anymore. That's what's changed since 2008-09. We have a new global finance capital elite sitting on top of everything, dominating the economy and increasingly dominating the political government systems. As you mentioned, what we got under Trump is a government in which the generals run the foreign policy, in which Goldman Sachs runs the economic policy, and you got Trump sitting up there on the second floor of the White House, twiddling his thumbs, issuing his tweets. And oftentimes messing up the whole situation in which then the people really running the government, Goldman Sachs, the deep state intelligence agencies, and the generals, those people really running the show, have to clean up his mess that he makes from time to time. He is the least actual president we've ever had. This guy is a real figurehead sitting up there tweeting. He spends most of his time with giving tours to business people who come, the door's wide open to his big corporate friends when he's not talking to them at 2 a.m. in the morning on the phone. What do I do next, Mercer? Or what do I do next, Adelson? It's it's a situation in the U.S. where we really don't have an elected president, and we really and the government has been slipping into the hands of the elite more and more. But the central banks are at the core of all this false money creation that is enriching the 1% incredibly, and allowing the banks, the private banks that are being enriched, and I mean the shadow banks as well, the hedge funds, the private equity firms, not just the J.P. Morgan Chases and the Wells Fargos. It's the shadow banks that have far more assets today than the commercial banks. And these are private, unregulated financial institutions that are global, and they move their money around, and they create all these liquid markets and move their money around and make all these super financial profits. This is the real power now behind the scenes, economically and politically.
Jack, how do we change this corrupt system?
Well, in my book, you know, I'm just focusing on central banks. Central bankers at the end of their ropes, because the policy since 2009 has been to rely totally on the central banks to generate any kind of recovery. As I said, the banks in the U.S. Were actually bailed out in 2010, but the government, the central bank, the Fed, kept pumping all this money into them because the system's become addicted to free money, addicted to low interest rates. And what I've argued in my book is that they're not going to be able to raise interest rates significantly without precipitating another financial credit crunch. So you're not going to see maybe one or two more increases by the Fed, if that. They can't get the federal funds rate above 2%. It's at 1.25% now. They can't get the Treasury yield 10-year above 3%. It's about 2.25% now without precipitating another crisis. So they're not going to do it. You know, it's the system.
Well, you know what that.
But
Jack, what happens is historically families lived off their savings 5% when I was growing up, and cost of inflation and adjustments in cost of living were anywhere between 1.5% to 3% per year. So as a result, today, if with this total non-existent savings that we have, even negative savings, where you pay a bank to have your money parked in that bank. And then no one's counting upon how much you're having to add each year for the cost of goods that increase, the cost of inflation in different markets. And it's not universal. The cost of food in a poor neighborhood could be 15% in a year. So We are not helping anyone with our current system.
No, well, you know, the massive liquidity, money injections by the central banks is what drives the interest rates down to near zero. And what happens when it's near zero, as you said, households have no savings, and they're living off, they're devouring their savings. But those low interest rates make the banks and financial institutions and their shareholders filthy rich. So what you're doing is taking trillions of dollars from mom and pop retirees in particular, living off their fixed income, and you're transferring it to the bankers and the shareholders. Trillions of dollars since 2009 because of the central bank low rates have been transferred from households who earn nothing, virtually nothing, to investors and financial analysts. One of the changes that has occurred, as you point out, is that people are living off of debt. For 20 years now, we've had virtually no wage increases going on, real wage increases in this country. Why is there no rebellion going on? Well, there kind of is now, you know, with what happened with the supporters for Trump and so forth. But the same finance capital elite who have, are enriching themselves, relying totally on the Federal Reserve, driving all economic policy now, are the same ones who have decided that, well, we're not going to give people wage increases, but we're going to give them more debt so that they can maintain their standard of living. You see, the debt works to the advantage of the corporate finance elite, but to the disadvantage of regular wage-earning households. They prefer it that way because rather than give you wage increases, they'd rather give you credit, because by giving you credit, they keep skimming off the top of your interest payments, your wages. They take back your wages by giving you credit. the system has evolved into a household private credit. At the same time, it's evolved into a financial credit on the private sector side.
Well said. Well, we're going to have to continue this conversation because we're out of time. I just want people to realize what he was just saying is every time you see one of those Capital One, we're giving you 1% back on every purchase and 1% back, well, they're taking 18%. So of course they're going to give you 1%. If they give you back 1% and you have to give them 18, but then that's only if you can make your payment every month. When you fall behind, they can compound the interest. So that debt that they're getting you to purchase things with, pay even for essential things with, they can end up, including payday loans, they can get 100% interest out of you, in some cases much more than that. That is predatory lending. That is vulture capitalism. That is wrong. So we will continue with Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, thank you for being on today, and hopefully people will read a very important wake-up call book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. Jack Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Walking through the park, it wasn't quite dark. There was a man sitting on a bench. Out of the crowd, as his head lowly bowed, he just phoned and it made no sense. He just go, I just couldn't help myself. Guess I was born with a curious